Probably a good sign. Good news is this is the last talk of the day. And also, I followed my instructions and plans on a Blackboard talk. Bad news is we're out of chalk. Okay.
Very clear.
So I'll try to be brief, and not writing will probably help with that. Right, so I don't know that much about holographic cosmology. I've been listening for 2 days, and in defiance of my own, I've been making notes on my computer, which I'll later try to decipher and figure out what you guys have been talking about. But I thought I could make some kind of general comments about how the field that I now work in, quantum information and quantum computing, might provide concepts that could be useful in cosmology. So what is this field? One way of characterizing it, I think, is that we are trying to rebel against what we were taught in school, which is that the microscopic world is the quantum world, like the world of individual atoms, and whereas the macroscopic world, the world of tennis balls and basketballs, is the classical world. And what we're hoping to do when we talk about building a large-scale quantum computer is make a complex quantum system that's highly controllable, which is really profoundly quantum, exhibits its quantum behavior even in a system involving many degrees of freedom. So aside from the frontier of particle physics at high energy and cosmology at long distances, there's also a complexity frontier, if you like, an entanglement frontier. Yeah. And we're trying to build more and more highly entangled systems. And so why do we want to do that? It's because we think that when systems become very highly entangled, we can't succinctly describe them in classical language or simulate how they behave. So we're looking forward to the advent of an era of quantum supremacy, where we can do experiments which consist of a sequence of steps, each of which is very simple to describe, but where the overall effect of all that steps is not something we know how to describe efficiently classically, and so interesting unexpected behavior might occur. And I think we're kind of on the same wavelength when it comes to trying to make quantum effects occur on large scales, because that's what you're talking about, right? The wave function of the universe, the quantum mechanics of the multiverse, and all that. So we have something in common. So one area in which quantum information might relate to the things we've been talking about is just the general issue of the foundations of quantum theory. There's been some discussion at this meeting about how eternal inflation, the multiverse, the measure problem all press us to think deeply about the interpretation of quantum mechanics and what it means to make a measurement, and the possibility that quantum mechanics needs some kind of modification. And thinking about things from an information or computational perspective can give you potentially insights into what types of modifications of quantum mechanics make sense. I mean, it's the funny thing about quantum mechanics, as many have noticed, is that it's sort of an island in the space of theories. If you try to change things a little bit, you get nonsense. So it's hard to form quantum theory in a way which doesn't give something ridiculous. And so one example of something that people have discussed from time to time over the years is, can we modify the evolution of the state vector, replacing it by a nonlinear evolution law? And that leads to a lot of problems. But an example of the type of problem it leads to is that when you have nonlinearity, it can mean that vectors in Hilbert space that start out very close together can splay apart and become more distinguishable. And that can make it possible to solve computational problems like combinatorial search problems that we expect, for fundamental reasons, at least from the point of view of computer science, to be hard problems. So one reason for being suspicious, and not the only reason, about nonlinear modifications of quantum theory is that it might give nature too much computational power. Another one of the themes of...
Why is that a bug, not a feature?
Sorry?
Why is that a bug, not a feature? We already know that
one modification of classical mechanics, quantum mechanics, makes some complications easier. Why couldn't it equally be true that...
Well, okay.
And in fact, it gives nature massive amounts of more computational power.
Well, yes and no. So So I'm talking about making the leap from what quantum computers can do to the ability to solve problems that are NP-hard or beyond. And that seems like a rather huge leap. So if we can really solve problems that are NP-hard in nature, it means that, by definition of NP, it means that we can solve any problem whose solution we can check, that we can, in effect, automate creativity, and so on. Put us all out of business, and maybe it would be great. But I think you might say that it's a reasonable hypothesis that the laws of nature won't allow that.
So, but nature is doing quite well in doing it, so maybe that explains it.
Well, so again, that connects with cosmology and what I was hoping for.
Cosmology or psychology?
No, I think the fact that we are being creative may have an underlying modern thing.
Well, okay. Oh, Craig, look at all this chalk. Well, that kind of connects with some things that I want to come to in a minute. But first, another point I wanted to make is that a central theme in the study of quantum computing is fault tolerance of quantum computing. And what it means is that we would like a quantum computer, which is imperfect and subject to noise, to be able to operate reliably and perform a large-scale computation. And it's very hard because decoherence is so pervasive, and we need some way of fighting it off. And the main idea for doing that is that we can encode information in some kind of non-local, subtle way, so that the noise, which tends to attack the system locally, doesn't really touch the protected information. It's only shaking around things that don't store the information that we care about. Okay? And that connects with something which hadn't really been discussed here, maybe for good reasons, and that is emergent quantum theory. It's become commonplace to think about emergent geometry, that we can get gravity from an underlying quantum theory. The idea that quantum mechanics itself is emergent is still regarded as more heretical, though I guess it hooked is one of the heretics. And the theory of fault tolerance gives us at least kind of a metaphor for thinking about a version of emergent quantum mechanics. Because the way these coding schemes work is, like I said, they store the information very non-locally. And so you can think about kind of coarse-graining a system, a fault-tolerant quantum computer, which in the ultraviolet seems to be noisy, and so that the coherence is not very strong. So I'll say not much coherence at short distances. But as you flow into the infrared, things become much more coherent. So in order to get a quantum computation to be reliable, we need to, in effect, store the information on larger and larger distance scales in order to protect it from the effects of the noise. So if we integrate out the short distance noise, we get something that looks like quantum theory, even though if we probe things at very short wavelength, it looks like there might be some kind of intrinsic decoherence. So one particular, not the only example of that, is one of the approaches to fault tolerance that we're hoping to realize, and that's using topological quantum field theories for quantum computing. We'd like to build a system out of ordinary stuff, like electrons, which has non-abelian anions in a two-dimensional medium, like a two-dimensional electron gas, where we can make an array of anions. We can keep them far apart from one another, so quantum effects that involve tunneling from one anion to another are suppressed. And in the case of non-abelian anions, there's a very large Hilbert space. If I have n anions, there are lots of indistinguishable ways in which I can glue them together, all of which locally look the same. So that if you inspect the particles one at a time, no matter what the quantum state is in that exponentially large Hilbert space, you see the same thing, because the information is really encoded in some global property of how the particles fuse together. And if it's made out of ordinary electrons, there will be noisy stuff going on, like electron scattering and thermal effects occurring at short distances if there's a non-zero temperature. But we can imagine integrating out that short distance stuff, and we're left in the infrared just with the topological field theory, which has a gap and has nice storage of quantum information. And furthermore, we have a way of processing it by performing exchanges of the particles, which acts in a non-trivial way on that protected Hilbert space. So we can do quantum mechanics in an exponentially large Hilbert space in a protected way, even though there's lots of noise occurring at short distances. So another theme of quantum information, which was briefly mentioned yesterday by Lenny, is the theory of quantum channels and how to send information through noisy quantum channels reliably. And a particular instance of that, which Patrick Hayden and I discussed a few years ago, is we can imagine a large quantum system, which we could think of as being a black hole. And then we add a relatively small system to it. We throw in a few qubits. And then there's some internal dynamics that's unitary that mixes up the new stuff with the old stuff. And then the black hole emits a little bit of radiation, but most of the degrees of freedom stay inside the black hole where they're hidden. And now we'd like to know if it's possible by inspecting the radiation to recover the quantum state that was thrown in. And so it turns out that if this black hole was actually entangled with another system, as it might have been if it had been created a long time ago and has been emitting radiation for a long time, with which it's highly entangled, then it's possible through the action of a decoding operation that acts on the part of the system that was entangled with the black hole before we throw in the new stuff, and the radiation, to do the decoding and find out what the quantum state is and recover it to good accuracy. And in order to do so, we only have to wait for an amount of radiation to be emitted, which has about the same entropy, just a little bit more than the entropy that we threw into the black hole. So the way this works is this unitary is some kind of encoding that protects against erasure. We can think of the stuff that's hidden inside the black hole as being erased, and with just the little part that's revealed, we can get the quantum information back. And it turns out that this mixing dynamics actually doesn't have to be such a complicated unitary transformation. It's something that could be done with some plausible Hamiltonian in a relatively short time. So that raises the issue of how quickly information can get scrambled by unitary dynamics, which Patrick's going to talk about tomorrow.
So, yeah. So you're asking about the unitarity of a subsystem?
The unitarity.
Is that effectively what you're... Because if you have U in there, then at some conceptual level you're happy that the black hole was symmetric.
Yeah, but I'm asking a more quantitative question, which is, yes, it's unitary, and if I waited for the black hole to evaporate completely, then in principle I could recover information about the full initial quantum state. But in this case, I have a black hole, I throw in some extra stuff, it emits radiation for a little while, it hasn't evaporated completely, and I'd like to know,
so
has it already revealed the information?
On top of the classic problem of material, this is sort of asking something different, right?
Yeah, it's a time scale question, and the question of how big a subsystem I need, as determined by this unit, chosen by this unitary transformation, to be able to recover a quantum state.
How does the size of the, how many particles have to come out in order to?
Well, if I send in,
that's the question.
Let's say k qubits of entropy, then I need k plus constant to come back.
So it's just linear.
If I want to recover the state with an accuracy which is like 2 to the minus c, something like this.
It's just
linear in k plus.
So stuff basically comes out as fast as it goes in.
Yeah, that's right. That's why we call it black holes and mirrors that kind of bounces back.
Right. Given that there's this huge entanglement, do you have to quantify that too? Or?
Well, actually, I was considering the situation in which this is a maximal entanglement between the black hole internal state and the auxiliary system.
Are you saying you know what U is? You know what U is?
Do I know what U is? I know that I can choose. Well, more or less know that I can choose a kind of random local Hamiltonian where the energy scale of that Hamiltonian is order 1, and let it operate for a time, which goes like log of the entropy of the black hole in order to do the mixing well enough. Well, actually, that's what you're going to talk about, right?
But in the reconstruction, you don't use any knowledge about you, except...
I do. Well, that's right. I need to know how the encoding was done to know how to do the reconstruction.
So you have to know you?
I have to know... So the presumption is that I know the internal dynamics of the black hole, right?
Yeah, but there's another way to say it, but I don't think you do really need to know anything.
Yeah.
It's the way you guys said it. That the bit that's thrown in is entangled with somebody else, Charlie.
Yeah.
And then to ask how the entanglement is transferred from the black hole to the outgoing hole.
Yeah, that's right. But nevertheless, to do the decoding map, I need to know something.
Right. Right.
So I'm just trying to avoid that extra layer of complexity.
Yeah.
But it's true that it's useful to consider the system we throw in to also be purified by being entangled with something. And then the question is whether that system that is entangled with the extra stuff that we threw in stays correlated with the internal state of the black hole or not.
Or
if the correlation gets destroyed quickly, which is why the information winds up over here. That's what we discussed.
So whether anybody can read it or not, the entanglement has been transferred to the other system.
That's right. Yeah, the entanglement here is lost, which means that there is a... this system is actually being purified here, so in principle, the information is recoverable. Okay. So the thing I want to talk about the most, though, is just the question of complexity, which I've already said something about briefly. So why are we interested in quantum computing? I said the reason a few minutes ago. It's because I think one of the most interesting things that we think we know about what makes quantum systems different from classical systems is that classical systems cannot simulate quantum systems efficiently. Well, actually, that's not something that we know how to prove, but it's a conjecture that's widely believed. And part of the reason we believe it is we don't know how to succinctly describe a generic quantum state. So if I consider a system that has many parts, like a book that has 100 pages, and I consider some typical quantum state of all those parts, it'll be an entangled state. And what that means is that if you look at the pages one at a time, each page looks completely random. There's no information there for anyone to read, so you can't distinguish one quantum state from another, and states are highly entangled by looking at the pages one at a time. Whereas if it were a classical book, you could look at the pages one at a time and accumulate the information that you've learned, and then you'd know everything that's in the book. And the reason that happens is that most of the information isn't in the individual pages, it's in how the pages are correlated with one another. That's the entanglement. And it's for this reason that we seem to not have a better way, a more succinct way in general, of writing down what the quantum state is than writing down, if I want to express it in terms of classical information, an exponentially long state vector. It's hard to encode all those correlations using ordinary classical data. And so that means there are a lot of quantum states that, in principle, we could make in the laboratory or find in nature, but we really don't know how to describe them classically, and we don't know how to describe precisely how they would evolve, even under some known Hamiltonian. And so we can consider sort of a classification of states. I'll call the first class classical. I don't really mean that they're classical in the sense of, you know, being basis states in some basis. But just that with an ordinary classical computer and maybe our pencils and ingenuity, we can describe and simulate these states and describe how they evolve under some dynamics that we can also describe succinctly. But then there's a larger family, which I'll call quantum. And that means we can't simulate how these states evolve with an ordinary classical computer, but with a quantum computer, we should be able to do it. Once we construct a universal quantum computer, then the simulations will be possible. And then there's something that lies beyond that, what we can simulate reliably, even with a quantum computer that we envision building and hope to build in the next couple of decades. So the natural question for cosmology is, where does the universe fit into this story? In which class? And all possible answers are interesting. Now, by the universe, I mean, it's not a very sharply defined question, because I mean the questions that we really want to be able to answer to get a fundamental grasp of what goes on in the multiverse or the early universe and cosmology. Well, it's possible that we can just figure it out and do calculations and run classical simulations and understand all that we care about cosmology. And if so, great, then, you know, more power to us and we can get busy. It's possible, though, that there are questions that we can't very well address because they require a simulation of quantum physics which can't be done efficiently with classical methods. And that would be good news for people who want to build a quantum computer, because it's the best application anyone has suggested. You'd be able to explain to, you know, the front page of the New York Times why we're building a quantum computer is to recreate the Big Bang. I read the same thing about the Large Hadron Collider. So we'll be doing that not at Fermilab, but at Feynman Lab in a few decades, recreating the Big Bang with the quantum computer. And of course, conceptually, the most interesting possibility is that there's stuff that dynamics that goes beyond what a universal garden variety quantum computer would be able to simulate, which is important for understanding what's going on in the early universe. That would mean that nature has greater computational capacity than we've given it credit for so far, that it can, in a sense, solve computational problems that we wouldn't be able to solve ourselves, even with the quantum computer.
John?
Yeah?
I'm just curious, I mean, how well-defined are these boundaries? I mean, some problems, if you try and solve them in a certain way, it's very hard, but then, you know, I don't know, lattice quantum field theory to solve exactly is very hard, but then if you're Seiberg and Witten, you can come up with some other way, you know, analytic way to solve it, and then it's not so hard, I don't know.
I think the boundaries can be sharply defined, however, figuring out where a problem lies in the map is not easy,
yeah.
Right? Because, in fact, to be honest, we don't really know that the whole thing doesn't collapse and everything can be simulated classically. Yeah.
So it's not the states, the systems you're calculating are not as complicated as the states you're using, the computer you're using. I mean,
so as I'm about to explain, so it's really a question about scaling of resources, and if we want to get a better and better approximation to the dynamics of some, large system, which you can think of as the size of the input to some computational problem, how do the resources scale? And maybe classically, you know, we would need an exponential amount of time to do the calculation, but quantumly we could do it in some reasonable amount.
But you would like the computation to be more efficient than running the thing itself.
Well, it's more efficient, I don't know. We would like to have a device which is a general purpose quantum computer, which we could use to simulate the universe one day. And that, you know, it's just like at the Large Hadron Collider. You do beyond the standard model physics for a while, and then you switch to doing heavy ion physics for a while. And we could do the universe run the universe for a while. And then we could run some big molecule the next week, which would allow us to discover a drug that cures cancer. So, of course, we'd like to know, this kind of sweet spot here where quantum computers are potentially important, the things that we think we'll be able to do quantumly and that we won't be able to do classically. We're trying to understand better what lies in that sweet spot. So we think there are probably problems in quantum chemistry, as I was just suggesting, which we could do a lot better with a quantum computer, or in material science. And it's natural to ask about, as has already been asked a minute ago, about quantum field theory, and what really are the resource requirements for simulating quantum field theory, And so why stop there? Why not also include gravity or M-theory? And as I already said, questions about quantum cosmology. To what extent do we expect to be able to do these things with our quantum computer on the days when it's not doing quantum chemistry?
I'm a little confused about something. Supposing I wanted to simulate the two-dimensional Heisenberg ferromagnet.
Yeah.
Would building a two-dimensional Heisenberg ferromagnet qualify as having built a...
Well, sure. I mean...
So why is it so hard? That doesn't sound so hard.
Well, I think you're right about the two-dimensional quantum ferromagnet. Okay. It is quantum... Actually, it's debatable whether it's classically hard, but, but it's quantumly easy.
Right.
And, it's kind of... It's like... you can build a little airplane or you can build a big airplane, and if you're going to test it in a wind tunnel, you'd rather build a little airplane. And the same thing with the universe. You guys talk about creating a laboratory, and that's going to be a great experiment. But if you could simulate the creation of a, it would be safer, and we might be able to learn just as many good things.
No, but I mean, if you build something that's a two-dimensional Heisenberg ferromagnet, that's all it can do.
Yeah,
right. So the idea of a computer is that you can do anything.
Yeah, we'll do the Heisenberg model on.
Try to cure cancer.
Right, but we'll also be able to do these other things on the rest of the days of the week. Okay, so I want to come back to this quantum field theory question because it's something I've been thinking about a little bit with Keith Lee and Stephen Jordan. I want to make another point. First, I guess in a way I've already made it, but it's worth making again. And, that is, at least from the point of view of computational complexity, we should recognize that we speak of big Hilbert spaces when we have systems with many degrees of freedom, but that's really, in a sense, an illusion. And so what I mean by that is the Hilbert space of let's say, n qubits has an enormous volume. So if you wanted to cover it with small balls, which have some constant size, the volume of an n-qubit Hilbert space would be exponential in the dimension. So it would be doubly exponential in the number of qubits. Mm-hmm. Now, so that's a lot of balls, as it were, to cover the Hilbert space. And but you could ask, how many states, or what's the volume of the Hilbert space that we could explore in some reasonable physical process? Well, you have to ask what you start with, and the usual picture would be that we start with a product state. So there's some preferred decomposition of our big Hilbert space into subsystems, like qubits, okay? And we start out with no entanglement among the parts, and then we'll let the system evolve for some time, governed by a Hamiltonian, which I can write as a sum of terms. And each one of those terms, I'll say, is local. But when I say local, I don't mean necessarily geometrically local in some dimension, just that each one of the terms acts on a number of subsystems, which is a constant, like on two or three qubits at a time, but it might be, any constant number of qubits in the system. And then I let it evolve for some time, but I don't want to consider times which grow explosively with the size of the system that I'm considering, so I consider a time which is, say, just growing like a polynomial in the number of qubits, like some power of the number of qubits. And then the volume that we can explore is just exponential in a polynomial in n. So it's extremely small compared to the volume of the whole Hilbert space. Okay, so there's this huge Hilbert space, and it's impressive to talk about it, but all the places we could ever go are this tiny fraction of the Hilbert space, and the rest of it...
This double exponential is the time scale for quantum funk radio?
Well, they both arise the same way, although the derivation is a little bit different, but in both cases, what's important is the exponential of the dimension of the Hilbert space.
Right.
So you would call it e to the entropy. So, yeah, that's right. A to B to the entropy. On the other hand, you guys don't seem to be fazed by considering times that are much, much longer than polynomial. This is a bit jarring for me, right? We keep hearing about this eternal universe and recurrence times that occur in times like e to the entropy. And, you know, that would be hard to simulate. If I wanted to have a simulation of the universe in which it's in thermal equilibrium and every e to the s, whatever time you like, it undergoes a fluctuation and starts inflating and becomes a universe. This would be an infeasible simulation, okay, by my standards.
So just need one recurrence.
Sorry?
You just need one recurrence.
Yeah,
so,
that's
sorry,
right.
N is the dimension of the Hilbert space?
N is the number of qubits.
Oh, the number of qubits. Oh.
So the Hilbert space dimension is 2 to the n.
Okay,
there are 2 to the n.
So isn't that the dimension?
It's the entropy. It's like the log of the dimension is the entropy.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Okay. So there's kind of a natural. So the universe is a state preparation problem. Okay. How did this state get made? And we'd like to know. Or I don't know, maybe you wouldn't like to know, but one can ask the question, in the sense of computational complexity, how feasible is the universe? Is it something in particular that we could simulate once we have one computer? And there's a related question, which is kind of natural to ask. This
would be a big stretch for me.
And that is, suppose we have such a local Hamiltonian, and we'd like to find its ground state. Okay, and by find it, I don't mean write down a succinct description of it, but prepare it, okay, in some quantum system, in a quantum computer. So I'd like to go from the Hamiltonian to the ground state. And, well, we actually know that, well, insofar as we know anything about computational complexity, but we're pretty confident, that in general, that's an extremely hard problem. Okay, even for a quantum computer, we don't expect all these statements about computational complexity are about scaling of the worst case complexity, right? There can be some Hamiltonians where it's easy to find the ground state, but there'll be some where it's extremely hard. And so we think, in general, you run into trouble when you try to prepare the ground state for a quantum Hamiltonian. Well, of course, the same thing is true even classically, right? Classically, you can have spin glass behavior, that's sort of the picture, the naive classical picture of the landscape, that a system can get stuck in a local minimum for a very long time. So even if it were at very low temperature, to relax to its ground state would take too long to be feasible. We'd just never be able to get there. The spin glass will never equilibrate. But what's kind of interesting about this in the quantum setting is there's kind of a general strategy that we can always use to prepare the ground state, which is to make an adiabatic change in the Hamiltonian. We could start out with the Hamiltonian, which I'll call H easy, for which it's easy to construct the ground state, and then we can try to adiabatically reach the Hamiltonian that we're interested in. And that'll be a successful way of making the ground state, with at least in a reasonable approximation, as long as the gap between the ground state and the first excited state doesn't become very small during the evolution. And by very small, since what we're interested in doing is preparing this in some time which grows only polynomially within, if the energy gap during the evolution scale like 1 over a polynomial of n, we consider that to be the good case. It would mean in polynomial time we'd be able to get the ground state. So we think in the hard cases, no, that isn't what happens. It actually gets smaller faster than any polynomial in N, which when you think about it, is kind of unusual for the quantum critical phenomena that we know of, where typically if there's a gap which goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit, it approaches zero only like 1 over a polynomial of N. In this case, it's something like 1 over an exponential in N. And the cases in which it's very hard to prepare the ground states are typically cases where the ground state is highly entangled. So, how am I doing on time?
We've got about 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. I'm in trouble. I'm going to talk about quantum field theory. Maybe I should skip ahead. Well, I wanted to, maybe I can do this quick. If we consider one-dimensional systems, we can imagine systems for which there's a mass gap. And for those systems, it's actually possible to describe, quite generally, it's possible to describe the state in a succinct way. What happens is, if I consider a large finite system of length L, and imagine cutting the system anywhere in the middle into two parts, and ask what the entanglement is between the two parts, the entanglement just goes like a constant in a gap system. And because there's just a little bit of entanglement, no matter how you cut things, it's possible to write down a succinct description of the ground state. And it's not hard to prepare it. That should have been GAP, not GAS. On the other hand, in the gapless case, what typically happens is we get a gap which scales like 1 over a polynomial of the system size, and the entropy goes logarithmically with the size of the system. And in fact, if it's a critical system that's described by conformal field theory, what determines the coefficient of the logarithm is the central charge, so it's something like that. In this case, too, there is a succinct, typically a succinct way of describing the ground state, and a way of preparing it, which is not so computationally complex, which is kind of a hierarchical procedure. It's what Guifre Vidalis called MIRA, the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, only kind of stood on its head. We can consider a single qubit, and then I'm going to draw a branching tree, and each one of the vertices, the tree really wants to grow, I see. And every time I draw a vertex, what I mean is I'm introducing another qubit into the system and then performing a local operation that entangles the new qubit with one of the existing qubits. And so the entanglement, which grows logarithmically, is built up in steps. And if I want to build a system which has total length L, the depth of this tree would go like log L. And you can think of that circuit, which is really a prescription for how you prepare the state, as kind of a poor man's version of emergent geometry. Okay, this, I would argue, has a kind of hyperbolic geometry inherent in it in the following sense. If I wanted to ask how entangled is this set of qubits with the rest of the system, well, the places where entanglement is generated between the interior of this region and the exterior are each one of these branches in the tree. And the number of branches that we have to cross when I draw that arc is only logarithmic in the total length. And then that connects with the prescription that Takayanagi and Ryu discussed a few years ago for understanding the entanglement entropy in a boundary field theory in terms of bulk geometry. They said if we want to find the entanglement in a region which has length L, then we should consider the minimum length curve in the bulk geometry that connects the endpoints of the interval. And because of the ADS geometry, that just grows like log L. And this kind of has the same feature, and it's characteristic of critical systems in one dimension. So if you wanted to take a very loose criterion for what it means to have emergent geometry or a gravitational dual, this is sort of like that. Where now the geometry, which is actually encoded in the circuit that builds the state, you can think of it as a prescription for building the state. So it invites you to think of the bulk description in ADS-CFT as some kind of prescription for building the quantum state on the boundary. Okay, so now I'm really out of time, right? Yes, you're not disagreeing. Well, let me tell you what I would have told you if I ran out of time. So, as I said, we've been thinking a little bit about the task of simulating quantum field theory on a quantum computer. there are three motivations for doing that. And well, one is it could be an important application, like I said, that we'll be running at Feynman Lab. And the second is just the issue of principle, of trying to understand to what extent such simulations are possible. And the third motivation is, I guess I would call it post-Wilsonianism. What I mean by that is Wilson acquired these very deep insights into the nature of quantum field theory, and I think an important element of what led him to those insights was thinking about how would I simulate quantum field theory on a computer, on a classical computer in his case. So it invites us to wonder if, you know, some grandchild of Wilson down the road, by thinking about running quantum computers to simulate quantum field theory, could also gain insights that we've missed up until now. So what do we do? Well, we want to simulate something in real time in quantum field theory. You know, as has already been mentioned, there are some things you can do in Monte Carlo, like you can calculate mass spectra, you can calculate static matrix elements. Real-time evolution is what's typically hard. So as a warm-up example, we considered lambda 5-4 theory in 2, 3, and 4 dimensions. And we just considered a scattering process in which we make some wave packets which have high energy so that many soft quanta are produced. And so in particular, if I do this in three dimensions where the theory is super renormalizable, the expansion parameter is really the dimensional coupling constant divided by the energy. So the ultraviolet behavior is pretty simple, but processes which produce a lot of soft stuff are complicated to describe the properties of the final state. So what we have to do is first prepare a state, then let it run, and then make a measurement of it at the end. Of course, we introduce a lattice spacing, and we regulate the field strength at each lattice site by saying that it scales with the lattice spacing to some power, which is just determined by the dimensions of the field. And actually, the number of them is supposed to be d minus 2 over 2. The number of bits that we need to store each lattice site is actually just a constant determined by the accuracy of the approximation we're trying to make. It doesn't depend on the lattice spacing itself. And then we start with free theory, in which case the ground state is Gaussian. And the Gaussian is simple enough that we can write down an algorithm for preparing the Gaussian ground state on a quantum computer, which is pretty efficient. Then I want to, still working in the free theory, make a wave packet. And I can do that by essentially simulating a process in which a qubit acting like a two-level atom interacts with the field and emits a quantum. At least that's one way of describing how you make the wave packet. But then we have to dress the wave packets. So we have to have the coupling starting at zero ramp up to lambda and do that adiabatically. And of course, while we're increasing the coupling, the wave packets are sitting around and they want to propagate and they want to spread. So we keep them tethered in a sense. They want to bump into one another, but we do the adiabatic turn on. So we turn on the coupling a little bit, then we evolve backward in time with the coupling fixed and do that many times. Mm-hmm. And then the wave packet is kind of frozen while it's getting dressed. It doesn't spread much and doesn't propagate much. Then once we got the coupling on, we can let her loose and let the particles hit one another. And then we're going to want to do a readout of the particles in the final state, and we can do that by adiabatically letting the coupling go back to zero. So now we know what the wave packet modes look like in the free theory, and then we can measure the modes. And the point of the exercise is to estimate the resources you would need to do all this stuff. And so I'll just say quickly, the two main elements to it. All this evolution, of course, you do it with a finite step size with some Trotter approximation. So there's some error coming from the finite time step, and you try to make that error as small as you can. And there's also an error in the adiabatic preparation. In particular, when these wave packets have very high momentum, it's fairly easy for the particles to split into nearly collinear particles unless we're careful during the adiabatic preparation. So we have to get an estimate on how big an error there is. Right, in a way, we're probably too conservative. So our estimate is based on no additional particles being produced, whereas really, if you were doing a collision between very high energy particles, you would expect them to have a cloud of nearly collinear particles when they bump into one another. I guess I should have said we do this when the mass is non-zero, so there's a mass gap, and that's what makes the adiabatic preparation work with reasonable resources. And in the end, things kind of turn out the way you might expect. At least when the volume gets large, what dominates the error is the error in the Trotter step during the evolution. And we can use higher order Trotter formulas to make that small. So the complexity in the sense of the number of gates that you need to do to simulate a volume V in time T really goes like volume, spatial volume times time, divided by lattice spacing to the space-time dimension, and then to some power which we can make close to, but not exactly one. So it's a little bit worse than linear scaling on the space-time volume. And then if we have to choose the lattice spacing so that we get good approximations for the wave packet dynamics that we want to consider, and since it's possible for one of the particles to carry a fraction of order one of the energy, the way the lattice spacing has to scale is with the energy. So 1 over A you can really read as the total energy. So this is an exercise. In this case, we don't get into any of these difficulties with encountering a gap that gets very small. To actually analyze things we had to make approximations, like doing perturbation theory and the Baire coupling, because otherwise it was too hard. But I think we have kind of a handle on the resources you would need to do the simulation in this case. Of course, it would be more interesting to do something like QCD, and in that case, probably the right thing to do would be to start in the strong coupling limit, where the vacuum is pretty simple, and then let the coupling ramp down while the Feynman scale gets large compared to the lattice spacing. So again, without encountering a quantum phase transition, we would expect to be able to get into the interesting dynamical regime. So just to sum up, the universe is a state preparation problem. It's interesting to ask, how hard is it? And if it's not too hard, but hard enough, it might be a lot of fun to simulate it on a quantum computer. And if so, that would be one of the best reasons for building a quantum computer so far proposed. Okay, thanks.
Any quick questions for John before we break for the photo and barbecue?
So earlier you were talking about these modifications of quantum mechanics that solve hard problems. Is there some abstract system that you can conceive of that would really efficiently simulate quantum mechanics? Or I'm not sure if that question even makes sense. Is there?
Well, so you're talking about the case of a system which is not described by quantum mechanics, but some deformation of it, and whether I'd be able to simulate that.
So I was
trying to suggest is that you might, as an academic exercise, even if you don't think it describes nature, want to simulate quantum mechanics deformed so that there's nonlinear evolution. But I would expect that to be a hard simulation. I would not expect a quantum computer to be able to do it very well.
No, but the real world turns out to have nonlinearity, and use it to simulate the ordinary quantum mechanics.
That's right. Well, that I can do. And I think, that's sort of the type of question that I'm trying to raise. What really is the computational power in nature? And maybe, like I said, there are things going on in cosmology that the universe is doing, which we wouldn't be able to simulate with the quantum computer we hope to build in this century, and that would be kind of exciting because it would mean there's more computational power encoded in the laws of physics than we have suspected. Eric?
I understand the rules for manipulating a quantum computer, but one thing I never heard is how to prepare it in its initial state. You told us that there's some special state you want to start from. But do I have a reset button so that I always get back to that state, or is it a complicated thing to sort of...
The state preparation is pretty simple. I just want to start out with n qubits in a product state. I can just measure the qubits individually, and I get a product state.
Yeah. Product state.
Yeah. Alex.
I have a question about the first two lines that you wrote in your talk about this classical quantum versus microscopic and macroscopic. Like, for example, Lenny talks about the proposition of states with the universe where bubbles, you know, nucleate at different places. And bubbles are very macroscopic things. They become arbitrarily large. And the reason is that, the argument is that for some reason you cannot, they cannot decohere. And my question is, suppose you have these macroscopic huge objects which do not decohere, but nevertheless, if you say move the WKB wave function of a bubble oscillates incredibly rapidly with the size of the bubble. Mm-hmm. So if you move, say, the nucleation time of the bubble by less than a Planck time, the phase will change uncontrollably. So I would expect that even if I don't have any decoherence, I would still should be able to think of these objects as classical.
Yeah, I guess that's right as a matter of principle. There are two routes to classicality. One is decoherence, which destroys quantum interference, and the other is having imperfect resolution, so we can't see interference fringes, so the average behavior we see is classical, which I guess does not intrinsically require decoherence to work.
Thanks again, John.
Okay, so
despite the...